This week, we cover the topic of theurgy. What is it? It certainly is in vogue in certain Masonic writings and presentations. Is it Masonic? Is there a connection? This week, we'll talk about the origins of what is known as theurgy, define it, and we'll get one author's interpretation of theurgy as it relates to Masonry in a multi-part series. Then we will have a new Masonic Mythbusters segment with Worshipful Brother Patrick Day. This week he's covering the Trial of Elements. Have you heard of them? Perhaps in any kind of Scottish Rite type degrees or even European degree systems. Certainly they must be legitimate and ancient indeed. Or are they? Brother Patrick Day's got all the details. All this and more. Stay tuned.
Welcome back to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. Here's your host, Brother Robert Johnson.
Welcome back. This is episode number 628. I want to thank our supporters of the show, contributors, fellows, producers, and legacy partners. The show is made possible because of you, and I cannot thank you guys enough. We all owe you a huge debt of gratitude. If you're curious on how you can help support the WCY podcast, head on over to WCYpodcast.com and click on Support the Show. We've got three levels on Patreon, and then, of course, the Legacy Partner, which is that fourth level. And those are all also available if you wanted to do or use PayPal instead of Patreon. All of that you can find on the website. One of the ways folks have been supporting this show for quite a long time is through the pin, our producer's pin. And this is something we take great pride in. And recently we've had a few orders, and I am attempting to fulfill those as fast as I possibly can. I've actually got a very limited supply left. So if you have ordered them, I am attempting to fill the orders, and if I cannot, please keep an eye on your email, because I will be emailing you letting you know that I'm out of the pin, and I have a new pin being designed as we speak. It will be a circular pin with the triangle inside of it, is what I'm hoping for, and a classic blue fill will surround the triangle. We're going to get those as soon as possible, and if we need to fulfill your order using those pins, I will be in contact with you as soon as possible. So, again, just keep an eye out on your email. As you heard in the top of the show, we've got a great Masonic Mythbusters with Worshipful Brother Patrick Day. But before we get into that awesome segment, I wanted to dive in to a topic that has started to gain a lot of traction. And that is the idea of something very, I guess, in vogue in the esoteric circles these days, is the practice or the concept of something called theurgy, T-H-E-U-R-G-Y. There have been a few Masonic books that have come out in the past few years diving into the concept of theurgy, and I think to start this off, we're going to read a piece that our good friend Christine Wilson Slack wrote for Universal Masonry about the Theurgic Foundations of Freemasonry, which is a multi-part series that she's been doing, and I highly recommend it. But to start with, we should talk a little bit about what theurgy is. So broadly speaking, it is really kind of a section, or at least related to, Neoplatonism. Platonism is sort of the Western style of what is later developed in the Middle East, magical and mystic systems, not unlike Kabbalah. So theurgy is essentially divine magic. And there is what we call theurgy and thaumaturgy. Now, theurgy describes the ritual practices associated with things like invocation, which is, again, it's a supplication, a prayer, or a spell. Or it can also involve evocation, which is the act of evoking or calling upon of the presence of one or more deities, especially with the goal of achieving some sort of mystical oneness, or sometimes the word henosis is used, which is a classical Greek word for mystical oneness. and the goal here is to perfect oneself. So we can give a little bit about the history in terms of Neoplatonism. Now, theurgy there means the divine working. The first recorded use of the term is found in the mid-second century Neoplatonist work of the Chaldean Oracles, Fragment 153, which was in Paris in 1971. The source of Western theurgy can be found in the philosophy of late Neoplatonists, especially Iamblichus. Now, although Neoplatonists are often considered pagan polytheists, it's important to remember they actually embraced a form of monism. In late Neoplatonism, the spiritual universe is regarded as a series of emanations from the One or from God. From the One emanated the divine mind, and in turn, from the divine mind emanated the world soul or the psyche. And Neoplatonists insisted that the One, or this divine God, is absolutely transcendent, and in the emanations, nothing of the higher was lost or transmitted to the lower, which remained unchanged by the lower emanations. In a weird kind of way, you can think about it as copying a copy over and over and over until the copy sucks, right? For Plotinus and Porphyry, the emanations are as follows. To Hen, the One, deity without quality, sometimes called the Good. Nous is the mind, universal consciousness, from which proceeds the psyche, or the soul, including both individual and world soul, leading finally to physis, or nature. Plotinus urged contemplations for those who wished to perform theurgy, the goal of which was to reunite with the divine, called henosis. Therefore, his school resembles a school of meditation and contemplation. Now, this is very similar. It should sound very interesting and similar, at least in terms of what is often talked about in Kabbalah and mastering perhaps all the different types of Sephirot and embodying all of these attributes to become in equilibrium to better align with God. Now, in Western esotericism, you have a couple of things that are very popular. Esoteric Christianity, which you might find in some forms of Rosicrucianism. And this esoteric Christianity, quote-unquote, we'd say, is it accepts theurgy as a tradition that could greatly benefit a person. The main feat of esoteric Christianity is to learn the mysteries of God and to rise to higher consciousness in the understanding of God's relationship to individual consciousness. Theurgy, in the esoteric tradition, uses this knowledge to heighten one's own spiritual nature. Some branches of esoteric Christianity hold that if an esoteric Christian or a Rosicrucian or a theosopher practices theurgy, it could potentially rise to the degree of magus or adept after a certain level of spiritual attainment. In a traditional and magical sense, theurgy is seen as the opposite of goetia, which is the European sorcery, right, often referred to as witchcraft, that has been transmitted through grimoires, books, and other tomes. Even though many argue that these two concepts overlap. Now, I mentioned Rosicrucianism, and kind of a spin out of Rosicrucianism in the earliest days was the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn. Now, some organizations, such as the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, teach a type of theurgy that would help one ascend spiritually as well as understand the true nature of the self and its relation to the divine and the universe. The Golden Dawn has a somewhat significant historical following and influence, and while it's held that many theurgists are usually solitary practitioners and seek the divine light alone through ritual and inner spiritual and psychological equilibration, theurgy in this hermetic sense stresses the need for the individuals to separate and analyze the individual components that constitute everyday consciousness and reunite them in a way that changes one's personal awareness into a state that understands and partakes in spiritual grace. So, make no mistake, however, these are in the Western esoteric tradition. If you want to take theurgy as its original intent, then you really need to look at how Iamblichus views this. And so, just a bit on Iamblichus, he's a student of Anatolius and Porphyry, the latter Porphyry, a student of Plotinus. And Iamblichus taught a more ritualized method of theurgy that involved invocation and religious as well as magical ritual. He believed theurgy was an imitation of the gods And in his major work, On the Mysteries of the Egyptians, Chaldeans, and Assyrians, he described theurgic observance as ritualized cosmogony that embodied souls with the divine responsibility of creating and preserving the cosmos. His analysis was that the transcendent cannot be grasped with mental contemplation because the transcendent is suprarational. Theurgy is a series of rituals and operations aimed at recovering the transcendent essence by retracing the divine signatures through the layers of being. Education is important for comprehending the scheme of things presented by Aristotle, Plato, and Pythagoras. The theurgist works like with like at the material level with physical symbols, at the higher level with mental and purely spiritual practices, starting with correspondences of the divine in matter. The theurgist eventually reaches the level where the soul's inner divinity unites with the One. So with that, let's check out Theurgic Foundations of Freemasonry, Part 1. This was posted on Universal Freemasonry at the end of January this year by Christine Wilson Slack. Quote, "The sun god, Ra, was described as the Ba, which came from the Nun. The Ba, which Nun created. In these terms, the Ba is a potentiality which is actualized. According to these statements, chaos produced order. Nun, primordial chaos, generated the god Ra, who then made the ordered cosmos. This is actually extremely similar to science's version of the Big Bang Theory. Randomness, primordial chaos, formlessness, or non-existence miraculously produced its opposite, a formed, ordered cosmos. In truth, science hasn't moved on at all from Egyptian mythology. It has no better explanation for how the cosmos was produced than ancient Egyptian priests spinning mythological webs did. From Think Like an Egyptian, How the Ancient Mind Worked by Steve Madison. This Egyptian myth of creation is not often repeated, and it has no name. But its theme of the power of the divine magic and duality is, I believe, a principal narrative on the path of humanity's perfecting. To understand this beginning, we first need to comprehend humanity's early understanding of the word divinity and the word magic. To the Egyptians, most especially in the Old and Middle Kingdoms, these two words were synonymous. Magic is the power of divine creation, although its characteristics were not defined in any translated texts. In the creation, noted in the quote above, what was not noted was that in attendance at this divine birth was the god Heka. Heka was considered the power, omnipotence, and wisdom that allowed Atum Ra to manifest. Thus, Heka and Heka meant the same thing, divine magic. Quote, "I am he whom the Lord of all made before duality had yet come into being, the son of him who gave birth to the universe. I am the protection of that which the Lord of all has ordained. I am he who gave life to the Ennead of the gods. Come to take my position, that I may retrieve my dignity, because to me belonged the universe before you gods had come into being. You have come forward because I am Heka." End quote. From Heka, The Practices of Ancient Egyptian Ritual and Magic by David Rankin. This fusing between the concepts of magic and divinity is a state that the modern mind, with its baggage of the past 3,000 years, cannot quite grasp. Quote, "To appreciate the Egyptian view of magic, we need to accept that the Egyptian magic was not considered strange or eccentric, but a part of daily life, to which everyone resorted. Magic blended seamlessly with religion and medicine, being seen as a part of a holistic worldview." End quote. An example of this mingling is the Egyptian Book of the Dead, or the Book of Going Forth by Day. These papyrus scrolls were placed in the sarcophagus of the dead so they could accurately recite the necessary spells and invocations to commune with the gods and to make the appropriate responses necessary to ferry their souls toward the afterlife. Spells in this context should not be interpreted as working to further personal gain or create a materialistic outcome. These were ritual texts set as guides to enable the dead to converse with the gods and goddesses and progress the human soul toward its journey to support the continuation of the world. The Egyptians did not see the realm of death, the Duat, as separate from the earthly realm, in so much as they are one world to be traveled. Both realms were inhabited by the gods and their intermediaries. The only difference is that one involved body and the other did not. These funerary texts were created around 5,000 years ago and were in use up through the Hellenistic period, throughout Egypt and northern Africa. One might say we've gone past the need for that kind of thinking. However, it seems that to understand the genesis of magic in our present construct of Freemasonry, we must understand the syncretic traditions that have been incorporated into our rituals. To understand where we are starting with the idea of magic, we need to be aware that to the ancient human mind, magic and divinity were one and the same. What is the magic we see within Freemasonry? To understand this, we must really look at Freemasonry's mission and purpose. To call Universal Freemasonry an esoteric masonry would be very fitting. Indeed, the Universal Freemasonry website has a statement about esoteric Freemasonry. It is, "Esoteric Freemasonry is not mere speculation or frivolous imaginings. It is the fulfillment of the work that Freemasonry itself charges us with. Our work is the creation of a universal religion, a solid foundation upon which all human beings can build. This can only be done in unity, and the keys to this unity can be found just beyond the gates that are guarded by the symbols of Freemasonry." To break this down, and for the purposes here discussing the magic involved in Freemasonry, we can say that esoteric Freemasonry has three unique and specific objectives. 1. Awaken the unused and underdeveloped inner human abilities, so its adherents can understand the symbols, allegory, and patterns delivered in its ritual. 2. Teach its adherents about the cycles of life and death in their small world and the universe as a whole through the process of catabasis. And 3. Stress the importance of the unity of human and divinity, which is known as henosis, the product of anabasis. These objects or aims are not done in any particular order or fashion, but are developed through the years of working together at a lodge, where the ritual is taken seriously and executed with thought. Development takes place through contemplation of symbols and using theurgy. Theurgy is also known as divine ceremonial magic. Theurgy may be seen as the framework of our Masonic ritual. The lessons contained in the three objectives of esoteric Freemasonry are cyclic in nature, much like the upward spiral we see within King Solomon's temple. Thus, they cannot be learned in a linear stream, but by repeated trials and approbations. As we move through this series, it will be important to remember that the modern mind and the ancient mind do not think the same way about cosmology. As esoteric Freemasonry is built on many traditions, including theurgy, it is most important to remember the distinction in the way of thought. From Oxford, we have this definition of theurgy: the operation or effect of a supernatural or divine agency in human affairs, a system of white magic practices by the early Neoplatonists. We will see in part 2 how the history of Freemasonry is infused with theurgy, in much the same way that the ancient world is infused with magic in everyday life. Now, if you'd like to read the other parts of the series, I believe part 2 and 3 are out. So for a Craftsman Plus, I'd love to ask you, what are your thoughts on this idea of theurgic practices? Can we call what we do in a lodge theurgic? Is what we're doing, maybe not verbatim as Iamblichus is offering, or perhaps the way the Golden Dawn or even Rosicrucianism might see this, but is there something to say that Masonry is theurgistic, if that's even a word, in that it assists the practitioner in becoming closer to God or developing that relationship, even though it is not a religion in and of itself? Although I might argue it is, but that's just my point of view. I'd love to know your thoughts. Next up, let's get into this awesome new Masonic Mythbusters with Worshipful Brother Patrick Day.
In a digital landscape filled with historical inaccuracy, out-of-context quotes on memes and soundbites, there is an epidemic of fraternal occult, mythological, and historical misinformation. It's time to set the record straight. Masonic Mythbusters with Patrick Day.
If you have ever seen the red degrees of Germania Lodge No. 46 of New Orleans, Louisiana, it really is an impressive ritual. They've come to Denver a few times, and it is quite a rite to behold. I don't feel there's any need to get into the history of the ritual, as that is clearly outlined on their website, which was largely produced by Arturo de Hoya. Basically, the lodge worked in German, and then their old ritual was likely a translation of William Morgan's expose, Illustrations of Masonry, with some modifications and corrections. Then, in 1940, the lodge adopted a hybridization of Jacques Fulhouse's Scottish Rite Craft Masonry Ritual and Louisiana's York Rite Ritual, which they exemplify, that they will travel to other jurisdictions to exemplify the first degree. It's really cool, and if you ever get a chance to see it, go. Do it. It's awesome. Highly recommend it. A particular interest in their ritual is the trial by the elements. Now, the last time I got to see this, I was voluntold to help with the air, water, and earth parts, which was really cool, until I realized I was sitting right next to one of the guys who was doing the trial by fire, in which he has a combustible powder in a container at the end of a long pipe, which he blows into a candle, and then this big plume of fire bursts forth. I thought my suit was going to incinerate. Now, this aspect of the ritual, the trial by the elements, is a curious one, and something that is heavily discussed in certain Masonic circles. There certainly is something kind of like this, i.e. the four classical elements in Masonic ritual, but it's not a trial. Rather, it's a punishment, the penalties for breaking the obligations. The entered apprentice penalty involves earth and water, the fellow craft involves air, and the master mason involves fire and air. So, where do we get this so-called trial by the elements? Is it a late evolution of the penalties? Or was it brought in by outside sources? Well, it's the latter, truth be told. So, let's dive in. Now, the earliest indication we have of any sort of trial by the elements associated with rites of initiation is in the 2nd century CE with Roman author Apuleius' Metamorphoses, or what St. Augustine called the Golden Ass, and this text would be the inspiration for Kafka's great absurdist work of the same title, Metamorphoses, in which the protagonist is turned into a giant insect. Now, I will call Apuleius' work The Golden Ass, just to not be confused with Kafka's work, or Ovid's work of the same name. So, The Golden Ass follows the story of Lucius, who is dabbling in magic, and in an effort to transform himself into a bird, accidentally turns himself into a donkey. Then he goes on this long journey to find a way to turn himself back into a man. Then, towards the end of the novel, Book 11, Lucius he's just utterly devastated. He has been through so much, and is still just a pitiful ass. And while laying on a beach, he begins to pray to the great goddess to deliver him aid. And when he falls asleep, the goddess Isis comes to him in a vision, and directs him to travel and seek out the priest of her eternal religion. And then he does, and is eventually turned back into a man and initiated into the mysteries of Isis. Now, Apuleius spends quite a bit of time describing the ceremonies, purification rites, bathing, fasting, what everyone was wearing, etc. And as Lucius begins his katabasis, or ritual descent into the underworld, he states, quote, "I was ravished throughout all the elements, per omnia vectis elementa." Now, there have been various translations of this passage. Adlington translates it as ravished, Hansen translates it as traveled, and on some rather spurious websites I have come across, they would translate it as purified. However, a very literal translation of this passage is, "I was carried through all the elements." Now, it should be understood that Apuleius is writing a novel, and a comical one at that. It is a work of comedy. Now, while the novel has a lot of serious and poignant moments, such as the tale of the old woman who tells Lucius this tale about Cupid and Psyche, it must be borne in mind that this is a comical work of fiction. So, how much weight do we give Apuleius's description of the rites of Isis? Some authors believe absolutely none, while others believe that it could be taken with a grain of salt, and maybe somewhat truthful. It's entirely possible that Apuleius was actually a member and divulged numerous aspects of the cult, or he could have been satirizing the cult based on what little he knew about it. It should be understood when we read Apuleius' description of Lucius' initiations into the mysteries of Isis, Serapis, and Osiris, the cults themselves were not being satirized, but rather Lucius himself is, owing to his apparent lack of understanding anything he is going through in his initiations. That said, according to Apuleius himself, he was initiated into several mystery cults. Quote, "I have been initiated into various of the Greek mysteries and preserve with the utmost care certain emblems and mementos of my initiation with which the priest presented me. There is nothing abnormal or unheard of in this. Those of you here present who have been initiated into the mysteries of Father Liber know what you keep hidden at home, safe from all profane touch and the object of your silent veneration. But I, as I have said, moved by my religious fervor and my desire to know the truth, have learned mysteries of many a kind, rites in great number, in diverse and ceremonies. This is no invention on the spur of the moment." End quote. He does not mention the cult of Isis, nor does he give much detail, but at the very least we may surmise that he had been initiated into some mystery rites. But beyond that, not much else can be discerned. His various initiations may have inspired how he lays out the rites, as described in The Golden Ass, but there simply is not enough known about the cult of Isis, or many of these other mystery cults, to ascertain how accurate Apuleius is being. Now remember, they're called mystery cults because what went on is a giant mystery. That's all. The purpose of this lengthy examination of Apuleius and his account of the mysteries of Isis is so we have a full understanding of the potential validity of his statement, "I was carried through all the elements." Was that really a thing? Was it a functional innovation? Was it his own personal commentary on the rites as he may have experienced them when he was initiated into this mystery cult or some other? The debate could go on, but suffice to say, this comical novel gives the first mention of any initiation rite that includes all the elements in its ceremonies. We may not even be talking about the classical elements of earth, water, air, and fire, but such indication is being given and certainly could be implied as such. That said, certainly other people have believed Apuleius' account and even assumed that these practices were incorporated in ancient Egyptian rituals long before Hellenic Greek mysteries, and future persons would use his ritual outline as their basis to, I guess, fill in gaps in their understanding of other mystery cults and their ceremonies. The most notable example, and in my opinion was the key text that forever stapled the trial by the elements into ritual initiations, is Abbé Terrasson's The Life of Sethos. Abbé Jean Terrasson was an 18th century French priest and scholar. His most popular work was a two-volume novel called The Life of Sethos, which was published in 1732. And he claims he translated this text from a Greek manuscript that, quote, "was found in the library of a foreign nation," end quote. Very descriptive, I know. The novel follows the life of the future king of Egypt, Sethos. Now, very early in the novel, Sethos desires to be admitted into the secret rites, and is at first rejected, but soon thereafter pursues it once more. He claims that Thales and Pythagoras were both members of this distinguished mystery cult. The entrance into the sanctuary was in one of the pyramids of Giza. Sethos is not given permission to be admitted, he just goes for it. He goes into the pyramid and descends a spiraling stair to the bottom of a deep well. As he passes through one of the numerous arches into the subterranean temple, he encounters the following sign. Quote, "Whoever goes through this passage alone and without looking behind him shall be purified by fire, by water, and by air. And if he can vanquish the fears of death, he shall return from the bowels of the earth. He shall see light again, and he shall be entitled to the privilege of preparing his mind for the revelation of the mysteries of the great goddess Isis." End quote. Sethos then undergoes a series of tests whereby he must pass through chambers and navigate the elements. He will pass through a room with fire and an iron grated floor. He'll find a path along the iron and in between the flames where he can safely pass. Next, he must pass through a water channel that is fed by the waters of the River Nile. He crosses this and comes to a chasm with a raised drawbridge on the other side. Above him are two iron hoops suspended by chains. He grabs a hold of these, dangles over the chasm for a brief moment as the bridge drops before him. He is then admitted into the inner sanctuary of Isis, where he beholds her cult statue and is caused to drink water from the previous channel and told, quote, "Let this water be a draught of Lethe, or forgetfulness with regard to all the false maxims which you have heard from the mouths of profane men," end quote. And then he's offered a concoction of Kakaon, which is the sacred drink of the rites of Eleusis, which is really just mint barley water, and told, quote, "May this be a draught of Mesimony, or memory for the lessons which will now be given you by wisdom," end quote. There is no mention of a trial by earth, but given the fact that Sethos is deep underground beneath a pyramid, it stands to reason that this is already the trial by earth. Taurasson's novel was immensely popular and highly impactful on both art and initiation rites. It would be one of the influential texts that inspired Mozart's The Magic Flute, and would inspire the enigmatic and strangely perverted French architect Jean-Jacques Lecoq, who did a rendering of a cross-section through an entire temple with its chambers and inner sanctuary in an ink-wash rendering entitled The Gothic House, Maison Gothique. Later authors believe Taurasson's work to be so real that near verbatim regurgitations of his descriptions of Sethos' initiations are included in what were considered legitimate works of intense academic rigor, such as Charles Hagthorne, who describes the initiation into the mysteries of Isis in his Secret Societies of All Ages and Countries, and he copies almost entirely from Taurasson's work, as so much so that he appears to be unabashed at his near blatant plagiarism. William Warburton also relies extensively on Taurasson's work as factual evidence in his Divine Legation of Moses. Moses Redding includes the purification of sins by the elements in a katabasis in his Illustrated History of Freemasonry. Leadbeater unabashedly cites Apuleius' Golden Ass for the source of his information on the Egyptian mysteries in his work Glimpses of Masonic History. There were countless other authors who looked to Apuleius and Taurasson for this information. Sometimes they acknowledge their sources, and other times they're kind of skirting around the fact that their sources are fiction. But all of them come back to the same two authors, Apuleius and Taurasson. The examples could just go on and on and on. In fact, you may already be familiar with this initiation narrative from any number of sources, and truth be told, whatever you were reading, it was certainly originally drawing from one of these two novels. The point is that so far, the two most influential texts on the use of the four classical elements in initiation rites are to be found in works of fiction, with no other factual information to support them. For Apuleius and Taurasson, it's permissible for them to make these things up. I mean, after all, they're writing novels. But how do we as Masons, men who are supposed to be guided by truth and reason and critical thinking, come to take all of this so seriously? No clue. Seriously, I have no idea. I would venture to say that some Masons were, like, trying to fill in gaps in Masonic legendary, and others just wanted these things to be real so badly that they convinced themselves it must be real. Trying to substantiate and fill in the gaps would be a venture of monumental proportions. Suffice to say, I have found no other uses of a trial by elements in any ritual form in the interim between Apuleius and Tresan. And its introduction into Masonic ritual most certainly originated in France via Tresan's Life of Sethos. I mean, I guess we get so caught up in myth and legend that we end up presuming these works of fiction were rooted in something much older, and therefore something real. And then when we look at our own Masonic rituals, i.e. the penalties of violating the obligations, and when compared and contrasted with these works of fiction, something resonates. It seems Masonic. I mean, I've even seen Mozart's magic flute used as evidence that these trials by the elements are Masonic, just because Mozart was a Mason. I mean, we seem to have skipped something here if we're relying on an opera as fact. I mean, we might as well take the movie From Hell as proof that Jack the Ripper was a Freemason, if that's how we're going to go about this. And it distorts things, even for serious academics. Take, for instance, Barry Bergdahl, who in a lecture on Jean-Jacques Lacue describes Maison Gothique as Masonic and claims this may even be evidence that the pornographic architect was a Freemason. I love Barry Bergdahl, and he's one of the most eminent architectural historians of our day. But these narratives of the trial by the elements as being Masonic even lead serious academics astray. I mean, ultimately we must consign ourselves to the fact that the trial by the elements were most likely and most certainly total fabrications, founded in imagination and later asserted as fact. All human institutions, customs, and norms were made up at some time or another. The older the tradition, the more it is deemed valid, what would be called evident by antiquity. So, we can safely say that the idea of a ritual application of the classical elements goes back about 1800 years, and is first mentioned in a work of comical fiction. Then it is later reinvigorated in another work of fiction, and those are our sources, fictions. It leaves you something to think about, I guess.
All right, how about that amazing segment? You know, I was lucky enough to witness a third degree of the Red Degrees. And I guess I had always thought that those were versions of the Scottish Rite degrees that were super, super, super old and that maybe came from earlier sources, but I guess there I go learning again. I found this fascinating, in particular the main topic of the trials by the elements, because you know, actually the first time I had ever even heard of the trial by elements was in a tarot deck, which was the Masonic Tarot, and when I opened it up, the white book that came with it was actually a very nice little cardstock book. It talked about Masonry and the Trial of Elements within it, and that's featured prominently in the cards. And what is interesting about this is while we might find current value in it, it seems as though we must admit this comes from a fiction. Perhaps not unlike Johann Valentinus André, who is largely considered the author of The Chemical Wedding. And knowing that this too was written as a lampoon, does it discount all of the work Rosicrucians have done over the years to better the world and dive into their studies? Certainly not. However, it is interesting to know the origins. So I want to thank Brother Patrick Day for shining a light on this one. I can certainly say, at present, now I know. That's it for this week. Thanks once more to our supporters, our contributors, fellows, producers, and legacy partners of the show. If you're curious, again, on how to support this program, keep quality and trusted Masonic education coming week after week, head on over to the website, wcypodcast.com, click on support the show, and check out your various options. A reminder about those pins, if you're going to order one, there's going to be a wait. And I do apologize, but it will be worth it, and I'll make it worth your while. And until next week, stay on the level. For Whence Came You, I'm Robert Johnson. Take care.
You've been listening to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry with your host, Brother Robert Johnson. Be sure to join us for our next edition.
Yeah.